From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, Michigan stands at 1 million COVID vaccinations delivered, but with so much more work to do.
We still need mass vaccination clinics. We still need drive-throughs, but we also need to have mobile vans and clinics and people going into neighborhoods to be able to vaccinate our most vulnerable populations.
Also, one small town's combustible mix of politics, health restrictions, and post-Trump fervor.
There was a real confluence of factors that we've seen both statewide and nationally really centralized in this small location.
And a long-running sled dog race in the UP makes the tough decision to cancel this year's run.
Some of our volunteers have come here every year for the last 20, 25 years. So it was quite disappointing to have to make this step.
Those stories and more coming up. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, one Michigan town's volatile brew of alt-right conspiracies, economic desperation, and Trumpian energy.
Protests over COVID-19 orders, questions over election integrity, and a movement that sent some folks to D.C. for that hearing.
That story coming up later in the hour. But first, as of Monday, Michigan has administered more than 1 million total of first and second doses of the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines. This is a big milestone, but obviously of little comfort to the millions of people, some of them essential workers or at medical risk, who are still waiting for their doses. State health officials are taking a breath and thinking about the next stage of vaccinations and COVID's continued spread in the community. Dr. Jonae Khaldun, Michigan's chief medical executive, testified before Congress this week about COVID response and vaccine distribution. And she joins us now. Dr. Khaldun, welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you for having me on.
Michigan has now reached 1 million doses. Does that mean 1 million doses distributed to counties and hospitals and institutions, or 1 million doses actually administered into people's arms?
That is more than 1 million doses administered in people's arms. That does include first and second doses, but we are incredibly pleased with the progress we have made in the state.
Should we assume that this is the pace Michigan will maintain for the next 7 weeks?
I expect us to continue to increase our rate of vaccinations. We've continued to improve week by week since we started about 6 weeks ago. And so I'm pleased with the progress. And I'll say the work of our local health departments, of our hospitals, of our pharmacies, and others who have really been on the front lines vaccinating people.
What do you feel has gone well up to this point in terms of the distribution of the vaccine doses? And what would you like to see improved?
Well, Michigan's actually one of the top states in the country when it comes to us drawing down, meaning distributing that which the federal government has made available to us. So we're doing a great job of that. Our partners across the state have really increased the speed of vaccinations. We've given them a target of 90% of the doses that they receive at their facility being in an arm within 7 days. By and large, our providers have stepped up to the challenge. I think more and more it's going to be important for us to really address our vaccination strategy from a lens of equity. We know that across the entire country, minority populations are not getting vaccinated at the rates of whites across the country. And we have to be strategic and targeted, not only in the way that we allocate our vaccines, but on the ground, the strategies we are implementing to get into neighborhoods to be able to vaccinate individuals.
I know that the guidelines for distribution of vaccine doses to the counties and institutions has been somewhat recalibrated in recent weeks, and that the State Department of Health and Human Services is now taking into account some CDC guidelines that include indicators of social vulnerability. In addition to regional caseloads, they're looking at population density, how closely together people are living, the factors locally that may affect people's health. How has that changed where vaccine doses are being allocated in Michigan?
Right. So in the very beginning, again, similar to other states, we were focused on those 1A populations, which were healthcare workers and people who were living or working in long-term care facilities. So the allocations were essentially based on that, the numbers of people in those categories across the state. as we've transitioned into more essential workers, into people who are over the age of 65, it's very, very important that we allocate based on this social vulnerability index that you've described. So like you said, things like income, education, minority status, language, access to transportation, those are things that are really important when it comes to access. And so we actually have a factor by which we multiply the allocations across every jurisdiction, and it impacts how much vaccine goes into those jurisdictions.
You said that the state needs to drill down a little bit further on equity. Can we expect that decisions about how doses are administered, that those decisions will continue to evolve?
Just like everything with COVID over the past year, we will learn more, we will evolve. And yes, I do expect things to evolve as we move forward with the vaccination effort. But I will say we have been targeted and focused on equity throughout the pandemic response. We were able to successfully bring down our disparity between African Americans and whites when it comes to COVID-19 cases and deaths. And so we will continue to build upon that progress when it comes to our vaccination efforts.
What more can the state do if it wants to, you know, further pursue equity in who's getting doses?
Well, we have to work with our communities, and that's one thing that we're doing with the Racial Disparities Task Force, with our Protect Michigan Commission that we just launched last week. We have to work with our communities, developing targeted messages, working with people so that people who are hesitant have a place to ask their questions and get their questions answered. But I think it's also about how we get into neighborhoods and address things like access. So those who are homebound, those who are disabled, those who may not have a car. And when I was the Detroit health director, I actually went into homeless shelters and I went into neighborhoods where at-risk people were. And I literally myself was administering vaccines. That's really where the best public health happens, is when you go into neighborhoods. So we're going to start seeing more of that. We still need mass vaccination clinics. We still need drive-throughs, but we also need to have mobile vans and clinics and people going into neighborhoods to be able to vaccinate our most vulnerable populations.
Right. There are some areas in Michigan that initially received more doses than they were able to distribute to hospital workers and folks in that 1A group, I believe over 75 or who are living in congregate care. And especially as the guidelines flexed out a little bit and allowed people, you know, included people over 65, some teachers. And we've been hearing that was due to several factors. In some cases, it was community resistance. You know, there were people who wanted to wait and see with the vaccine. Sometimes the institution that's doing the vaccinating had logistical problems that they were dealing with. Of the vaccines that have been distributed in Michigan so far, do you know how many have gone to folks in the 1A priority group and how many went beyond?
You know, I do not know that off the top of my head, but I can tell you in the very beginning, and this is part of the work that we had to do, it was not just about doctors and nurses in healthcare settings. It was also about environmental staff. It was about security officers. Anyone who was working in a healthcare setting where they could be exposed to people or to infectious materials. So we had to make sure people understood how broad that category was. As we moved into 1B, of course, we had to think differently about how we distribute the vaccine. So that's why we're now engaging more pharmacies and FQHCs. So as we move forward with the different populations, we will pivot and be able to reach the populations that we're trying to reach with these eligibility groups.
Is the state tracking who's getting the vaccine? What kind of demographic information do we have about people who've actually taken at least one of the shots?
So we do have age data that's on our website right now. We are actively working through our race data. We do expect to be able to post that at some point. Right now, there's so much data that is missing. We have to do a lot of work to try to make that data more robust so that we paint the accurate picture when we do post it. But I'll tell you, I know that there are going to be disparities when it comes to racial and ethnic groups and who's getting the vaccine. There's no question in my mind that that exists, which is why we are laser focused on implementing our strategy and addressing equity.
What else is the state doing to make sure that the process of booking and traveling to vaccine appointments is accessible to those who need it? You did mention mobile units and that being an issue, but there are folks maybe whose internet access isn't that great, even if they are mobile. Are there other channels that the state's been exploring to try to get the word out that people need to make the appointment?
Absolutely. So we understand that not everyone has access to internet or a computer, which is why we've asked our local health departments and our hospitals to have phone appointments available. We are also working with 211, so people can actually call 211 to help get their appointments scheduled as well.
Is 211 directing people to appointments at this time? We heard that in the early stages, some people were calling and being told that they couldn't make an appointment that way.
Well, we've been building that out over the past several weeks. Again, all this capacity is new. There's never been this scale of a mass vaccination effort ever in the country. So we have had to build out that capacity. So local health departments have phone lines, but also 211. If you call 211, they can also help you.
Going back to the macro picture of how many COVID-19 vaccination doses are available domestically right now, there was a revelation early in the year that the national stockpile was not, in fact, a national stockpile, and that the federal government last year did not make arrangements to make doses available that would be under federal control. Do you know how many doses the federal government has right now, or is that information being provided to the states?
You know, I do not believe that there is some secret stash of vaccines. I've had great conversations with the Biden administration. They're doing everything they can to make vaccines more accessible to the states. That's why you've seen the additional 20% that's coming out to states. That's why you've seen them. They're going to be allocating to pharmacies now moving forward in the upcoming weeks. And they are moving forward with purchasing additional vaccines. So I appreciate the transparency and clarity, quite frankly, from the Biden administration and look forward to more of that in the upcoming months.
Dr. Joan A. Khaldun is Michigan's chief medical executive. Dr. Khaldun, thanks for talking to us.
Thanks for having me on.
Ask anyone how vaccine distribution has been going at the county level. They have a slightly different story to tell. Tomorrow at this time, we'll hear what happened in Hillsdale County, where a scarcity of doses and community resistance to vaccination have yielded some very mixed results. Please do join us Thursday to hear more. Elsewhere in Michigan, COVID has led three popular sled dog races in the UP to cancel this year's runs.
We would have trouble even with masks and all the other protocols we could put in place. We weren't sure that we could do a safe race and facilitate it with those restrictions.
We'll talk with one of the organizers about what it was like to make that decision and how it's affecting the racing community and the Marquette area. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Earlier this week, we were talking about the decrease in ice and snow cover this year and how that's impacting our regular outdoor winter pastimes up north. That's on top of the COVID-19 pandemic, which has already made getting together difficult during winter tourism season, and not just at the slopes. Normally, if you were to travel to the Marquette area in February, you could catch a pretty unique annual event, the UP 200, a sled dog race. It's one of the Iditarod qualifiers, and it's about 230 miles in length, running from Marquette to Wetmore to Grand Marais and back in the Upper Peninsula. Now, usually the races run in mid-February at the same time as two shorter races called the Midnight Run and the Jack Pine 30. But how many times have we had to say this? Not this year. Here to talk with us about the races and the very tough decision to cancel them for 2021 is Darlene Walsh. She's the president of the Upper Peninsula Sled Dog Association. Darlene, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you. April, I enjoy talking with you.
So for those who've never been there, can you give us an idea of what race week is usually like? I guess when it's not a pandemic year, what's the atmosphere in Marquette?
Very festive. It's a very large event. We estimate usually on Friday evening at the start of the Midnight Run and the Jack Pine 30, we would have approximately 5,000 spectators downtown. It's got a snow trail put on the main street downtown. It's called Washington Avenue. Washington Street has its track put down for about a half mile through town. All the businesses have their white lights from Christmas left over, so it looks very festive. And a lot of cheering, a lot of dogs, several teams. We usually start roughly 30 teams out of downtown Marquette on Friday night. So it's a very exciting time. And then we have people stretched all the way along the race route to cover road crossings and provide safety for the teams as they go by. So it is very exciting and quite festive.
I guess I was coming at this thinking about racers out in the woods, sort of remote from each other, but it sounds like there's quite a few moving parts. There are the mushers and the dogs, but also the vet crews, the volunteers, the local businesses, and of course the spectators. How many people are we talking about here getting together for race week?
Typically during race week, we will have approximately 900 volunteers who help us out. We also have vet crews, as you've already mentioned. We usually have about 20 to 25 people involved with the vet crews that include veterinarians, vet techs, and vet students who are learning this, volunteering. We also have, like I said, about 30 mushers between the Midnight Run and the UP 200, and approximately another 15 to 18 in the Jack Pine 30. So each of those teams come from out of the area and bring their own crews with them, usually a driver and a handler or two. So we are talking thousands of people. We also have volunteers who make the trek to the UP every year from Wisconsin, the Chicago area, as well as downstate Michigan. Some of our volunteers have come here every year for the last 20, 25 years.
Wow.
This would have been the 32nd running of these races. So it was quite disappointing to have to make this step, but we felt we could not keep all of those competitors, all of the volunteers, all of our race officials, our veterinarians, and our spectators safe during this very odd year. One thing I would add is that about half of our volunteers are Northern Michigan University students. So we wanted to take that into consideration as well.
I'm sure that there was a lot of conversation about, you know, could it be done? And if so, how would we do it? What sort of extra safety precautions would it have taken to try to pull off the race with that volume of people?
The main things we talked about were having scaled back coverage at various road crossings, because you certainly don't want to have a large crowd of people there. The main challenge that we faced was not being able to have any spectators. We really were not sure in such a public venue as what we have in the Marquette area, how we would be able to monitor that. On the trail, our concerns were much less because, as you mentioned, mushers go out on their own. They are socially distanced. Even when they're on their dog teams, they're typically several feet apart if they can even see each other at all. So the teams on the trail were perhaps the least of our worries. It had to do more with our checkpoints because everybody has a starting point, but along the UP 200 and Midnight Run Trail, there are also mandatory checkpoints. That is where the teams do come together. They, again, could be socially distanced, but the vet crews, the timers, all the checkpoint volunteers, we would have trouble even with masks and all the other protocols we could put in place. We weren't sure that we could do a safe race and facilitate it with those restrictions.
Darlene, in addition to running the UP Sled Dog Association, you wear multiple hats, like lots of folks in the UP. You're also the township supervisor for Sands Township in Marquette County. Are there ways that your responsibilities to the township inform the way you thought about the conditions for the race and just whether or not it could be done safely?
Yes, there were. As the township supervisor, I am also the COVID point person, which meant I was reading all of the governor's orders, all of the Michigan Health Department orders and restrictions, all the guidelines from the CDC. So it was something that I came to the UP Sled Dog Association board with that knowledge and also tracking pandemic trends, both statewide, regionally, and in the Marquette region. So when you start gathering all that kind of information, and then you're looking at, okay, how can we safely put together this kind of an event and adhere to the restrictions that are in place? The two things came together in an interesting way. I'll put it that way.
Yeah.
We started having the discussions in the fall. We knew that we would make a decision no later than November because we wanted to let all of the people who travel to get here know with enough lead time to make their plans.
I can only imagine this is yet another blow economically to the region after a year of really very difficult economic conditions.
Yes, we did an economic survey last year with people coming up to the race. We asked them to fill out a form. We kind of laughed. At some points, we got a little bit insistent. Would you please fill out this form? But enough people did. And we worked with the Lake Superior Community Partnership to analyze that data. It corroborated economic survey we had done in 2014-15, showing that the economic impact in the Marquette-Elder region is just under $2 million each year. So we were very cognizant of that going into it. We also were concerned. We have a lot of sponsors. That's how we function. Donations and sponsorships are what fund these events. And we weren't sure how our sponsors were going to be able to manage contributions. Some would be able to. We were worried about small businesses, whether or not our funding would be in place and whether that was even reasonable to expect. So the economic impact is kind of the double-edged sword, because we know it brings in income, but it also requires us to ask people for donations. And that gets difficult when you know people's businesses have been suffering.
Yeah.
So this year, what we're doing is we are celebrating our sponsors, acknowledging who they are, and we're forging ahead and planning for 2022.
If you're just tuning in, I'm talking with the president of the Upper Peninsula Sled Dog Association, Darlene Walsh, about the cancellation of this year's annual UP200 sled dog race. What kind of response were you hearing from contenders and folks who are usually spectators and community members about the cancellation?
For the most part, it's been very supportive. The good news is we hear people are disappointed. It would be a little bit disconcerting if we found out that they weren't disappointed. But overall, I think that the mushers that we've contacted, as well as the spectators and the volunteers, all understand, and they do recognize that their own safety and everyone else's safety is an important factor. So most of them have rolled with it fairly well. We are selling merchandise on our website that commemorates the year of no race. It's the only time we've had two race years on one t-shirt or sweatshirt, the different merchandise. We have a design that was made for 2021, so we stayed with it. And on the merchandise, we have 2021, and then we have the saying running on by to 2022. On by is a mushing term. When you want your dog team to move ahead and pass any type of distraction, you tell them to go on by. So we are running on by 2021, heading toward 2022. So we're laughing because this is the only year we will have two race years on one piece of merchandise.
Oh my gosh. You organized these races, Darlene, but I know you've also been a contender yourself. What does the cancellation mean in the course of people's training schedules?
It makes it difficult, which is partly why we wanted to make a decision early so that people knew how to train their teams. They knew what they were training for. You do start with your dog team over the summer and into the early fall, getting organized and laying out your training plans based on what races you intend to compete in. Sure, it's very disappointing for mushers this year because you have your team of dogs, you've been building these teams. Sometimes you run into a scenario where this may be the last year for a particular dog. So it's very disappointing. But you can also flip to saying, well, this is the recreational year, time to regroup, time to get our team all together. But it has been challenging. One of the things we took into account is many of our competitors and some of our judging crew are Canadian. Given the current situation, they would probably not be able to get here, or if they did, they wouldn't be able to get back home. So we pretty much knew early on that they would not be able to participate. So it has made it difficult for mushers this year, for sure.
There are so many organizations that have had to cancel events, whether they're athletic or just recreational or otherwise. Do you know of other races or winter tourism activities in the UP that have had to change their plans?
Oh, it seems that nearly most of them have. Most recently, the Nakaminon ski race. They had originally planned to socially distance everyone, start skiers in waves. They finally determined that it needed to go to an all virtual event. So they have come up with a mechanism for that. It just seems like one after another, ever since the fall, every event in the area seems to have had to make adjustments or out and out cancel, and most of them have canceled. The Munising Ice Festival would also be happening at this time, and they have had to cancel. You know, the bottom line is, even if you're outdoors, when you have that many people gathering for an event, it's just not the right time to do that.
I wonder how you're finding ways to fill the time when you'd normally be extremely busy. You mentioned that the association is doing a lot to acknowledge its sponsors right now, but is there anything that you're working on at the moment?
One of our board members has reached out to all of the mushers and some of our other long-term volunteers, board members, to send in video clips of what they are doing now. We're especially looking for our mushers to do that so that we can put together a montage and put it on the website in order to let everybody know we're still out here and this is what our competitors who usually come to these races are doing this year. We have quite a list of things that we're trying to accomplish during this year. We decided early on that in spite of having no event in February, we would take the opportunity to kind of reconnoiter, I guess, and get some of our documents in place. We certainly have a safety plan even under normal conditions. So all of those things need to be updated. We also operate what's called the UP200 Dryland Dash. Normally it's held in October in collaboration with the Wisconsin Trailblazers Sled Dog Group. We were not able to hold that in October, but we're already looking ahead toward when we might schedule that and hold the next Dryland Dash. So basically we are looking at holding our Dryland Dash in 2021 and moving on into the 2022 snow races.
Can I ask, what are some of the clips that mushers have sent you so far? Was there anything interesting about what people are doing?
It's top secret.
Oh, come on.
Actually, April, the reason I said top secret is because I can't answer it. One of our board members is collecting it. Mushers have until the 7th of February to submit to her. And I have not seen any of it yet.
It's all good. Listen, I know that this must have just been a very hard decision to make in a year that was already challenging and full of sort of fear and tough conversations. What's been getting you through?
I think what's been getting us through is knowing that we are still all very interested in this event and looking forward to next year. And for me personally, I live in a rural area. Winter is still here. We don't have as much snow as what we would normally have. But I feel very fortunate that we are in an area where we can still enjoy the outdoors. As far as the Sled Dog Board goes, we have enjoyed each other's companies. We've been meeting via Zoom, which is a little bit interesting for most of us, but we've been making it work, and keeping that connection has been very important to us. You know, we still recognize the value of this event, and we are excited to be looking forward to 2022. We still could use all the support we can get, and we need people to help us take on certain tasks. So if we have anybody out there in the listing area who would like to get involved, they can go to our website and send an email to the UP Sled Dog Association, and we will connect with them.
Darlene Walsh is president of the UP Sled Dog Association. Darlene, thank you for talking to us.
Hey, thank you, April. I enjoyed it.
Have you seen the incredible video that's been making the rounds on Twitter this morning? It's of these two bald eagles floating down the Detroit River on a chunk of ice, just seemingly nonplussed as they pass by Belle Isle. The video was taken by none other than Anna Marie Seisling, a producer at WDET in Detroit. And she's with us now. Hey, Anna.
Hi, April.
So were you as surprised as we were to see these eagles just floating down the river?
You know, it really was kind of a special treat to see them on that giant chunk of ice. I go to Belle Isle quite often, and I hadn't seen them in probably like a month or so. And was out over kind of just looking at all of the ice and just couldn't believe it. I saw this like big kind of brown splotch in the distance. And when I looked closer, they were just there, two of them floating down the river. It was pretty amazing.
Bald eagles went through a period of really terrible decline, but they're now on the rebound. Is this the first time you've seen them there on the river?
Well, it's not the first time that I've seen them on the island. I've seen them dozens of times, but it was the first time that I saw them floating on a chunk of ice in the way that the video shows. And, you know, I'm no scientist, but it definitely was kind of this moment that I think is illustrative of ecosystems and of species kind of making their return to Belle Isle. And also, I mean, in this moment where we're living in, you know, the insurrection in Washington, D.C., all of the kind of division and rhetoric being used to divide Americans. To me, it really did kind of feel like this beautiful moment of just like, look at these two eagles. You know, to them, this is just another day. They don't know what's going on outside of just enjoying this moment, trying to look for some fish. It was pretty cool.
Anna Marie Seisling is a producer at WDET. She shot this incredible moment of the bald eagles pretending to be penguins on the Detroit River. Anna Marie, thank you so much.
Thanks, April.
You can check out the video on Stateside's Twitter feed. Find us at Stateside Radio. In just a moment, we visit another town in the UP, Calumet, where politics and COVID have collided.
Protests over COVID-19 orders, questions over election integrity, and a movement that sent some folks to D.C. for that hearing.
More after a break. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. With the COVID vaccine in distribution, it feels as though there's a light at the end of the pandemic tunnel, even if still it's at a distance. But in Calumet, a small town in the western Green Bay Packers-loving part of the Upper Peninsula, the fight against any change in daily life due to COVID has raged and continues to rage as maskless patrons crowd a local cafe that's ignored state orders at every turn. Here with a profile of the political and social firestorm ignited in Calumet is Jonathan Osting of Bridge, Michigan. Jonathan, thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks, April.
The profile of Calumet that you published this week has so many twists and turns. Before we unpack some of what you reported, will you tell us why you decided to do this? What got your interest about this town of about 750 people?
Yeah, well, I've been doing some deeper reporting on sort of extremism and its sort of rise in the past year. And as part of that, you know, I was looking at folks who broke into the U.S. Capitol on January 6th. One of those people who's been arrested and charged by the FBI was from Calumet. So I started, you know, looking at this region and trying to figure out what was going on and, you know, realized there was a real confluence of factors that we've seen both statewide and nationally, really centralized in this small location. So protests over COVID-19 orders, questions over election integrity, and a movement that sent some folks to D.C. And also, you know, just a real sort of animosity towards public health officials trying to enforce some of the orders that the governor has set up. So, you know, the local health official, Kathy Beer, told me that because the region wasn't hit as hard with COVID early on, like, say, Detroit, that really affected the perception of the pandemic up there and maybe led to some of the angst and anger we're seeing now.
It's hard because we didn't have that rush up front like everybody else did, so people got tired of waiting for it to show up. So they're very burnt out by waiting. And, you know, now that it's here, people are just tired.
At the center of this story is a cafe owned by a brother and sister that has been resisting the state's COVID rules and restrictions. It's called Cafe Rosetta. Would you tell us about it and its owners?
Yeah, so Cafe Rosetta is, you know, sort of a quaint cafe right on the main street in downtown Calumet, which, by the way, is really beautiful, has a lot of historic architecture from the mining boom back up there many years ago. But Cafe Rosetta has really just been flouting public health rules for months now. They actually had their food license taken away by the state, and they've lost some court battles over that, been fined for contempt of court for staying open. But they were very much open, you know, last week when I was up there. I actually went to that cafe and sat down with one of the owners, and the place was packed, and there were literally no masks there at all. Not much attempts at social distancing either. I did wear a mask, two of them actually, but I was the exception rather than the rule. And the cafe has really just become sort of a flashpoint in the region, with folks who are protesting COVID-19 orders sort of rallying around the owner and dining there as well.
The owner, Amy Heikkinen, and her brother, did they say that their decision to stay fully open was a business decision or more of a philosophical and political one?
Well, it's certainly become a major political issue up there. You know, you've got lawmakers and county commissioners talking about it and taking sides. But yeah, they argue, Amy in particular I talked to, argues that, you know, she just, you know, didn't think she could survive if she had to shut her dining room down again during the last pause that Governor Whitmer and her administration ordered.
Yeah, my goal is to stay in business and, you know, hopefully keep it that way, but beyond politics, you know, and I don't know if I told you that, but it's not political for me. It's just the right to work and earn a living.
She, you know, says she's a mother of six who had fled an abusive relationship and, you know, doesn't want to go back to, you know, food stamps or being dependent on others, you know, and feels she's finally, you know, found some success as a business owner and wants to keep it that way.
So, Jonathan, how have Amy and her brother been able to stay open? I mean, they've been fined. They've lost their food service license. What's going on here?
Well, that's a question I asked pretty much everybody, and the answer seems to be a lot of folks are saying, well, somebody else should do it. This, you know, the court orders are a civil matter, the licensing dispute, and there hasn't been an order from the judge to forcibly shut down the cafe, so state police haven't taken that step. The county sheriff, you know, basically says he's just, you know, a middleman here. He doesn't have the authority to shut down the cafe either without a court order or a law strictly saying he should. Now, it's my understanding that under state health rules, you know, there's potentially a mechanism to take criminal action here, but the state has not gone that route yet. So for now, you know, the restaurant is, Amy told me she was going to pay the first contempt of court fine she had received and was hoping to still win back her food license on appeal. The matter is, you know, not over legally, and she's continued to keep trucking.
I think the situation is extremely unfortunate.
I spoke with Tanya Rule, who's a health official up there, and she's been the focus of a lot of anger from supporters of Cafe Rosetta and those resisting the COVID-19 orders that she's tasked with enforcing. Tanya says health officials are just trying to do their jobs.
I mean, I worked with Amy and her mom. I sat in the conference room with them in 2018 and helped them through the paperwork process, the plan review process to open their business. I, more than anyone, wanted her business to be successful. I was a customer of Cafe Rosetta prior to July of this past year. If you look in my wallet, I have two Cafe Rosetta punch cards. But I just don't think that, you know, the whole thing is unfortunate. Her personal opinion does not put her above the law.
There's another figure that looms large in your story, and that's a local businessman in Calumet. His name is Eric Killinen. How did he become sort of the flamethrower of this narrative?
Well, he's a local businessman who's, you know, been pretty successful. He owns a couple businesses in the region. And, you know, he initially started fighting COVID orders when one of his own businesses was briefly shut down. He created a group called All Businesses Essential, basically encouraging companies around the state. He did this even on billboards downstate to, you know, defy the orders, bring people back to work and treat all employees as essential, because at the time that was, you know, one of the delineation marks. So he has, though, really, emerged as sort of the leader of this anti-government movement up there that's sort of fed into, the conspiracy theories.
There is no pandemic. This is a manufactured crisis to allow Biden to steal an election, as far as I'm concerned. That's precisely what happened.
And although he acknowledges that COVID is real, he thinks that deaths are really blown out of proportion and just a part of life. So he's, organized protests. He has taken out a full-page ad in the local newspaper to criticize the regional health department. And he's really rallied around Cafe Rosetta. When I talked to him, he actually joined Amy the co-owner at Cafe Rosetta and appears to really have, focused on that cafe as sort of a real fighting point here. And he's hired a public relations firm even to take their story national.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Jonathan Osting of Bridge, Michigan. He's published a story this week on Calumet, Michigan, and the very particular brew of politics and COVID restrictions that have come together in a pretty combustible way there. There's a man in your reporting, Jonathan, who got some attention for being part of the group that stormed the U.S. Capitol during the January 6th insurrection. He's a Trump supporter, a racist, and a conspiracy theorist. And he's also the adult son of a respected former state legislator. Can you tell us more about who he is?
Yeah, sure. So this is Carl Dresch. He's a 40-year-old man who was born nearby in Hancock, where his family lived, and had since relocated to Calumet. And really, we don't know a ton about him. I wasn't able to talk to him or his family members because he is locked up still. We can see from his social media profiles and activity that he'd really gone down a deep rabbit hole. He was very immersed in this local resistance movement with Cafe Rosetta. He had eaten there. He had, complained that or championed them for taking on the communist state government, as he called it. But more troubling than that, he was really promoting, the conspiracy theory that led to the Capitol insurrection, which was that. The election was rigged to benefit Joe Biden over President Trump. He has suggested that if folks didn't do anything, quote, if we let this election get stolen, there's going to be war. He also, really showed a sort of extremist streak earlier in the year, when the governor was the subject of a kidnapping plot that was foiled by the FBI. He lamented the fact that she got off on a technicality, meaning he hoped that those folks would have potentially kidnapped her and made what he would call a citizen's arrest of the governor because of her COVID-19 orders. And then on another social media channel that a lot of folks don't know about, it's called Gab. It was a real, rallying point for conservatives at points when they were fighting Facebook. He really opened up there and exposed some deep racism. He used the N-word. He used racial epithets against Jewish people. He smeared gay people and really, showed sort of a very troubling side in the run-up to this. And sort of, you can see a pattern emerging of how he became radicalized in the months leading up to the Capitol insurrection.
We should take a moment to just note that the median household income in Calumet, as you report, is about $21,000. That's household, not individual. It's just a very low figure, about a third of the average household income anywhere in Michigan. How much do you think the poverty of the region has been driving the political fire?
Well, I think it's a big part of it, certainly. I mean, this is a region that, has gone through some really tough times. As I mentioned, it was a boom town at one point and still has this beautiful historic architecture. But it's fallen a long ways. And, now there's a lot of folks who are struggling to get by. And the community is also, trying to rebuild itself. There is a neat downtown scene still. And, there's hopes that new development is going to come in. But there's a lot of just sort of fear, you know, that things aren't the way they used to be, which I think is another thing, you know, another factor that we heard from folks who really rallied around President Trump in 2016 and 2020, you know, longing for the way things used to be. And you can definitely get that sense in Calumet. Now, the village of Calumet is just a tiny pocket in a larger region. There's a lot of communities surrounding it. And in some of those communities, there have been some folks moving in from other parts of the state or country that are bringing a new perspective there. And they're the ones who are really feuding, in some respects, with the, you know, anti-COVID regulation folks. And it's set up this, you know, really tense dynamic between folks who, you know, are taking COVID seriously and folks who are not taking it seriously. There's been, you know, verbal altercations on the street. There's been a lot of name calling on social media. One local business owner told me she knows folks are hesitant to come downtown because of the, you know, demonstrations that have happened at Cafe Rosetta. So while I was up there, I spoke with Roy Britz, who's one of the Houghton County commissioners and is also a deputy police chief at Michigan Tech University in Houghton. And he, you know, expressed some real fears about what was happening up there. Here's what he said.
Absolutely. I think that we're at a tipping point. I think that there's risk of civil unrest at any given moment. People are being tired of being pushed around and people are tired of not being able to live their lives.
Jonathan, do you know if any of the people you talked to for your story contracted COVID?
I don't know if they, you know, I didn't talk to anyone directly, but certainly it's, you know, around Christmas time, there was a spike in cases. The school was shut, the middle school was shut down last week because of a recent outbreak. Eric Clunan, the local business guy, you know, he told me actually he knows a few people, including both his parents, but that still doesn't really concern him because they both survived.
Yeah, COVID exists. Do you die from it? 99.5% don't. Or better. So we shut down the world for this? You know, get real. And yeah, you don't want it. You know, has my family had it? Yep. Guess what? My father just had it recently. He's just recovering right now. My mother had it, then hardly heard her. And they're 83.
Is he aware of the overall death rate in Michigan and in the United States?
He is, yeah. While I was there, though, he was pointing to a now, you know, mostly debunked analysis of CDC death statistics, and he was suggesting that the death rate, you know, actually isn't all that unusual. That's not the case, I mean, according to public health officials, but it's an argument he was making. He also, you know, spent a lot of time railing against heavy-handed government, suggesting, you know, tyrants of the past like Pol Pot or Mao Zedong have been responsible for more deaths than this pandemic, which, by the way, he doesn't think is actually a pandemic. So, yeah, he you know, basically questions the data.
Jonathan, you have these two realities throughout the state of Michigan when it comes to COVID. While the virus has now reached every county in the state, there are definitely pockets that are averse to any kind of action. And it seems like it does depend, in no small part, on where you live. What would you say all of this has to say more broadly about the political divisions in Michigan and maybe the entire U.S. and how they've deepened in recent years?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's very illustrative of that, and it's sort of a sad state of affairs. You know, a lot of people I talk to up there, you know, still consider, you know, youpers to be friendly and cordial people and seem to be taken aback by what's happening in their own community. So, yeah, I think this is a microcosm of those dynamics we're seeing nationally. You know, it's a real open discussion about what happens next, and folks are grappling with how to heal those divides, just like they are at the state and national level as well.
Jonathan Osting is a reporter with Bridge Michigan. You can read his story about Calumet, Michigan online. Jonathan, thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Thank you.
And that's Stateside for today. Our show is produced by Aaron Allen, Mike Blank, April Van Buren, and by our director, Mercedes Mejia, with additional help from Catherine Nguyen, Nell Ovett, and Olive Scott. Our executive producer is Laura Weber Davis. Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcast service of the University of Michigan. I'm April Baer. Thank you so much for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.